This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Overall, we're looking about probably in the vicinity of about 20% of species within any particular given geographic location disappearing by the end of the century.
That is Australian biologist Corey Bradshaw, professor of global ecology at Flinders University, Adelaide. Corey returns to Radio EcoShock with this update from the real world of living things.
They've said that there'll be a 7.22% fall in GDP by 2100 from a 3.2 degree increase in Celsius in temperature. What they're doing is really saying you can find the footprint for global warming in current data. And that's just nonsense, because it's a cascading effect, and it's the runaway process that we are now very, very close to triggering. That is the really scary thing. The complete structural breakdown of our climate will occur over the next 80 years. And all these predictions are just nonsense.
Then, why do top economists claim global warming over 3 degrees will cause only minor damage to the economy? From the Analysis.News podcast, Colin Anthes interviews Australian economist Steve Keane about crazy numbers from the people who advise governments, banks, and business. I'm Alex Smith. It's all Voices from Down Under this week on Radio EcoShock. Children born today will see literally thousands of animals disappear in their lifetime as global food webs collapse. That is a quote from new research by two established scientists. One is European Commission-affiliated scientist Dr. Giovanni Strona. The other is our guest, Professor Corey Bradshaw at Flinders University. From Adelaide, Australia, Corey Bradshaw, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex. Good to be back.
Yes, well, I think we should begin by introducing the idea of co-extinction. What is that, and why are we just kind of learning about it now?
Well, co-extinction, the concept has been around for quite some time. I mean, theoretically, at least, going back probably over a century, it's kind of one of the fundamental aspects of ecology is that all species are, of course, connected in some form. No species lives in a vacuum. They all depend to some extent on other species, just like human beings depend on, you know, all the species we eat and the species that take care of our ecosystem services, like producing oxygen, for example, or purifying our water or sequestering our carbon. So we all depend on living things within the biosphere. So co-extinctions, they're really actually quite simple. If a particular species goes extinct and then all the species that depend on that species cannot shift their relationships, whether it's something they eat or another resource they gain off that species, they too will ultimately go extinct. So it's this idea of an extinction cascade. Or co-extinction is the term we're using here. So it's only really been in the public eye really in the last few years, because we've realized that many of the forward projections about future extinctions don't really take into account this aspect of extinction cascades or co-extinctions.
And you and Giovanni also talk about edge species. What are they? I looked up edge species, and they are, you know, those that are at the strange ends of the evolution spectrum, you could say.
I don't think that's the definition we're using here. Let me just, we actually use edge in two ways. One is, it's actually, an edge is considered the interaction within a network, so the relationship between two species. The other aspect of edge is the limits of a species' particular tolerances to its environment. So in this case, we're using primarily precipitation and temperature. So it's the edge of their niche, if you will. So what they can withstand, their physiological capability. So that's how we're using it in this context. From like network terminology, that is beyond even ecology. I mean, we've stolen a lot of the network principles from computing, IT, and physics, which we've adapted to biological systems. But the terminology used to talk about the connection between two modes is an edge as well. It's a little bit confusing.
According to your comprehensive analysis, what is the best and worst case scenario, in a nutshell, for extinctions this century?
Well, overall, we're looking about probably in the vicinity of about 20% of species within any particular given geographic location disappearing by the end of the century. So what that looks like is, in reality, we're not talking about extinction per se. Extinction is the loss of all individuals within a species. We're talking about biodiversity loss. So this is, for example, you look out your window today and you count the number of animal species that you see. And then you look out that same window in 2100 and you count the same number of animal species. On average, you're going to see about, well, the exact number we came up with is about 17.6%. So about 20%, or one in five species disappearing. So that's about double what we had anticipated previously from climate change by just looking at the thermal tolerances, that is how much temperature extremes particular species can withstand before they go extinct.
So it's the interrelationship of animals that create a kind of a feedback effect that make extinction higher than we thought.
Yeah, well, you can think about it like this. Let's say, the obvious one is predators and their prey species. So if a particular predator specializes on eating a particular prey species, and it's not a generalist, as we say, it can't just eat whatever's going. It tends to specialize on particular species, and most predators are, in fact, quite specialized. Then if the prey species go extinct, then the predator has nothing to eat because it doesn't have the time to evolve a response to a different sort of diet. So it goes extinct. And really the timing is key here because over evolutionary timescales, of course, things wax and wane, and if there are slow changes, evolution can kind of take over and adapt the species to the new situation. But the climate change is happening so quickly that most species don't have much time to adapt. There is some adaptation, but it's very small. And we've actually coded in that adaptation into the model. But now you can think of other relationships like pollination is a great example. So many flowering plants have very specialist animal pollinators, mostly insects. Some birds, some bats, that sort of thing. But if those specialist pollinators, and many pollinators only pollinate a few, if not one species of plant, if those pollinators go extinct, then the plant can't reproduce, and ultimately it'll die out and it can't, make any new individuals for the next generations. Or something else that probably goes by the wayside for many people is parasites and their hosts. Parasites usually tend to be very host-specific, and if the host dies, then all the parasites that depend on that host will also go extinct. Now, a lot of people think that that's not necessarily a bad thing. Who wants parasites? But parasites are kind of fundamental aspects of many ecosystems, and without them, we wouldn't have the same diversity that we have today. And it turns out that probably many of the big extinction events that have happened in the past, a large part of that has been the loss of parasites, which has really taken biodiversity and knocked it on the head.
So as I see it, you created a model to test responses by a representative cast of vertebrates to different levels of climate change. And it almost sounds like a game with virtual animals, but a lot of math in the engine. Is that a reasonable description? And can you cross-check this study with what happens in the real world?
Yeah, so obviously a model is an abstraction. One of my favorite quotes is from the late George Brooks, who's about a statistician. He said that all models are wrong, but some are useful. So all models are by definition an abstraction or a simplification of a complex universe. But what they try to do, if they're useful, is to garner the main tendencies within a system. And models really only become useful when they're used in a comparative sense. So we contrast one future scenario with another, and we look at the relative change. It's not saying that this or this will happen. It's just like this is much worse than this situation, for example. So, yes, it is an abstraction. Each of the individual species therein are actually not linked exactly to every species on the planet. We are making virtual Earths, but we're not doing an exact replica of Earth. We still don't have the data or the computing complexity to be able to do a completely virtual Earth, but we can get the main dynamics pretty well. And one of the ways we validate that is to look at the inherent distribution of diversity on the planet in a spatial sense derived from the primary inputs of the model. And it turns out, based on real data, that we can actually put the actual pattern of biodiversity, relative biodiversity, that is the number of species per unit area, across the entire globe really, really well. So we kind of know that this system is operating in a realistic sense. We're also using real data to look at this, for example, the distribution of species in different groups of animals, also in how they adapt to their environment. So this adaptation aspect, their dispersal rates, the proportion of species in different levels of a food web, for everything from the top predators right down to the herbivores. Now, where we don't have great information is the dynamics within the plants and the invertebrates. That's mainly due to the fact that we don't have great data on those kind of linkages between those different groups and then their linkages to the vertebrates above them. So our model actually assumes that the primary resources, that is the plants and the insects, are inexhaustible, which is not the case, actually. So you can take our predictions as actually quite conservative, because if catastrophes happen really at the bottom of the food web, in the plants in particular, we vastly underestimated the extinction rates, and that's even scarier.
So we hear a mass extinction event could be developing right now, and then we go back to our lives and social media feeds. Humans just don't grasp this situation well. Could you paint us any photos of what living through a die-off would be like?
Well, the way I describe it to many people is that the future is not going to be very nice. It's actually, the term we use is ghastly. Now, that's an evocative and emotive term, but it basically means that our lifestyles and our standards of living will plummet, and they already are starting to plummet for many people in the world, especially the people with the fewest resources. The poor are getting nailed the hardest by climate change, for example, climate refugees, warfare, loss of food production, that sort of thing. Lots of suffering, ultimately lots of death, and really a poorer standard of living for all people. Now, the wealthiest will be buffered from that for some time, and that's probably why we don't hear a lot about it, is because that buffering is happening as we speak, but those are the people that kind of control the media. We, the wealthy people of the world, even though we're a minority, control most of the information flow. So until it affects us directly, and, it is starting to do that, both in terms of, say, for example, floods and bushfires, extreme heat waves. It's starting to sort of trickle through, but the severity of the implications down the track haven't even begun to hit home with the people that control the information flow. Now, we try as we might with, scientific endeavor to educate people about the severity of this. It's in a lot of ways, I remain pessimistic that most people won't do much until the crunch actually happens.
You list five dominant drivers in this sixth mass extinction: land use change, overharvesting, pollution, climate change, and biological invasions. I'll bet most people put land use change first, like burning down the Amazon, as the number one cause of extinctions. What did you find?
Yeah, well, there's no question that in the past, especially in the last few hundred years, and the massive expansion, especially of European colonization around the planet, the main driver has certainly been habitat loss, cutting down forests, turning plains into agricultural areas. Those have been the primary drivers of species loss up until quite recently. But climate change will take over that loss. We've included in these particular models projected trends in continued habitat loss right to the end of the century. And it turns out that that's actually quite a minor component of the overall extinction rate once you take extinction cascades or co-extinctions into account. Now, that is surprising some people, and to be honest, during the review process, it even surprised our reviewers. But when you think about it objectively, much of that legacy effect, so the previous extinctions and the extinctions that will happen because of past deforestation due to something we call extinction lag. So often you'll get, for example, an area that's deforested, a lot of those species will die immediately, but a lot just sort of move into smaller patches. Ultimately, they're doomed, but it takes many generations of those species. And if you can think of a long-living tree, for example, generations can be measured on a century scale. It takes some time for those extinctions to be realized. So we're still living the legacy of past habitat loss related extinctions, but if they haven't already, they will very soon be taken over by climate change because of these extinction cascades.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is the Matthew Flinders Professor of Global Ecology, Corey Bradshaw. We are talking about wildlife disappearing as this century unfolds. Corey, you've published and spoken on the dangers and costs of invasive species, and Australia, biologically isolated as it was for so long, is particularly at risk, and there's been some bad examples, the rabbits, the cane toads, we could go on. So with global business and travel, humans are mixing in large cities, but is globalization a good idea for the other species?
Yes, it's not a good idea for other species nor ourselves. I mean, we've done some work recently showing that we're, you know, invasive species cost the planet somewhere in the vicinity of several hundred billion dollars a year, and that's increasing. So just in terms of gross economics, you know, damage to crops, the cost of managing invasive species, the precipitation through the loss of other species, native species that are useful to us, have direct economic detriment. And I'm really, when I'm saying hundreds of billions, I'm not exaggerating. So the other aspect that invasive species do is, of course, they weaken native ecosystems and the connections between species because they tend to simplify those systems. So they can replace some of the functions of lost native species, but generally speaking, they take over components of those ecosystems and dominate them, which makes them overall less resilient to disturbances. So invasive species actually make everything else worse. Now, we weren't modeling invasive species, so you can look at our work as taking some of the two main drivers of extinction, putting them together, so that's climate change and habitat loss. But happening over top of all of that are things like pollution and invasive species and overexploitation that contribute even more to extinction. So as I said earlier, our models are actually extremely conservative from that respect.
Is the issue of invasive species separate from climate change?
Yes and no. There's no direct necessity for an invasive species, its dynamics to be related to climate change. But many species do respond to it positively. For example, the movement of tropical species into temperate zones, let's say insect vectors of diseases, malaria, dengue, that sort of thing, they can expand their ranges, and many invertebrates are in fact expanding their ranges because of this warming effect. So we're tropicalizing many parts of the temperate world. And the tropics harness more species, but they tend to be dominated by those that are the most generalist and that have the most damage. So climate change can facilitate invasion of alien species, but it's not a necessary part of the invasion process. Most invasions actually happen from direct or indirect introduction by humans through commerce.
Your virtual world also finds species get smaller as the world gets hotter, and I have heard that from other science. Does that mean, though, that we lose the large iconic animals like elephants or bears first?
Yes. Those species tend to have very large ranges to garner the resources necessary to maintain those large bodies. So there's a really good relationship between the size of an animal and the area over which it roams, and that's really just so that it can gain the essential resources it needs to complete its life cycle. So if resources are limiting in any sense, they become the first to drop off the perch because they can't complete their life cycles. Now, if you're smaller, there is one advantage of having a smaller area in which you are required to garner those resources, and you can withstand certain perturbations that might affect larger species more intensively. But the downside of that, of course, is that if you're restricted in range, one small disturbance event, for example, like a bushfire or a cyclone, can wipe out your entire population or the only population left in the entire species, which means that you're susceptible to these random events that wouldn't necessarily knock out a species that's spread over a much larger range. So it's kind of a balancing act. This is why we have both large and small species that have evolved, because there's a certain advantage under certain environmental conditions, either to being big or being small or anything in between. This is the diversity we have on the planet. But when things change extremely rapidly, as they are today, and due to entirely the human endeavor, the bigger things tend to drop off the perch first, yes.
Why do you and Giovanni Strona say, quote, the bleakest time for natural communities might be imminent?
We said that because some of the processes that we modeled, their starting points were actually within the next few decades, if not even this decade. So the processes that ultimately lead to co-extinction are starting now. So the more we can limit the changing temperature profiles now, the less likely co-extinctions will occur in the future. So one of the interesting components of the model is actually the middle range climate projection scenario based on an emissions profile that's sort of mid-range from what we expect over the next few decades at least, is the scenario actually had some of the highest co-extinctions because the very high-intensity warming scenario, more species went extinct from primary extinctions. That means exceeding the thermal tolerance. In other words, we had already lost those species, so there were fewer species to lose from these cascading effects. So really, it's about stopping the cascade early on in the series, because otherwise we're going to not be able to get a handle on this sort of runaway extinction cascade thereafter.
Many of our listeners worry about collapse and resiliency. In your new paper on the extinction crisis, you remind us of a 2016 paper by Strona. It suggests life systems that look strongest may actually be the most fragile. And that sort of reminds me of the collapse of the Soviet Union or the Lehman Brothers, which we never thought was possible. But in living affairs, what does Strona's work say about surprises in the survival of animals?
I think a lot of Giovanni's work and our own together suggests that it's really difficult to predict what a collapse might look like or how many connections must be lost in a complex system before things collapse. Even collapse is kind of a loaded term because it depends how you define that. Is collapse simply a loss of overall function? Is it a loss of diversity? Or is it wiping out the entire community? There's various interpretations of what that means. But I'll come back to the current paper. We did find that the number of connections within these systems actually dropped more than the number of species being lost. In other words, you think about it like a latticework or scaffolding. You know, you can knock out bars here and there, and the scaffolding still stands up. And up to a point, it looks strong and it looks intact. But you knock out, that last bar, and the whole thing will start to crumble. We don't really have a good handle on when that happens, but we do know that when you knock out bars from the scaffolding, you weaken the entire structure. That's why we have, the entire thing intact to begin with, so that it withstands those kind of shocks, like, wind coming along or some, earthquakes or whatever that might knock that scaffolding down. The fewer bars that link up the pieces that exist within that scaffolding, the more likely it is to collapse under another kind of disturbance.
And now we have big foundations to save iconic wildlife. People do care about animals, and some of these foundations work to create protective islands of nature for tigers or butterflies. But, Corey, do they know about climate and co-extinctions?
Generally speaking, our conservation approaches are very much behind the ecological understanding. There are pushes within conservation biology and the conservation science in general to incorporate some of these. So there are processes and plans to do things called assisted migration, for example. So that's taking species that perhaps might be adapted to a particular area today, but in 50 years they won't be. So considering about moving species to anticipate the changing climate. There's also the idea of genetic rescue, and taken to the ultimate extreme would be genetic modification through things like CRISPR technology, where you can actually provide a genetic resilience to species by shifting species around and adding different genomes into populations. So there are aspects of this, but generally speaking, it's hard enough just to get an area put aside for species to conserve them, let alone anticipate all the future challenges that they'll face. That's extremely true on land. It's probably more flexible in the oceans, but even then, I think just the ability to make long-term plans is compromised by the fact that the wheels turn very slowly in commerce and economics.
You present startling numbers about the way things should go. Do you have any cautions about this paper and what studies are still needed to make us even more confident about this dark picture of extinction?
Yeah, a couple of things I've sort of alluded to over the course of the interview. One is getting a better handle on what's happening with the plants and the insects. You know, a lot of people are alluding to the loss of insects around the world. You know, you hear everything from insectageddon to, you know, catastrophic loss of all sort of main pollination services. We're not exactly sure what's going on because we don't have great data, unfortunately. And even though, you know, insects in particular make up most of the animal species on the planet, it's important that we really get a handle on how these interactions among species at the lower trophic levels are happening. And so we have to make the models a little bit more complex as a result of that. The other thing is to look at extinction per se and not just biodiversity loss. So that's taking into account the geographical distribution of species within these models and to try to anticipate the total loss of individuals from the species. In other words, extinction as opposed to just a geographically specific loss of biodiversity. The final step, well, not final step, but certainly the third priority from our perspective is to do the same sort of modeling in the oceans, because we've only looked at the land surface here, and we'd like to incorporate the same methodology to look at extinctions in the seas. Slightly different system, both in terms of, you know, for example, dispersal is very different, but it has a lot of influences of oceanography that are a little bit more uncertain than our global circulation models. So it's going to be a challenge, but we need to get more data and more models, basically, to be able to get a real sort of robust picture of what's happening.
You've just made me think, well, extinction isn't everything. You kind of reminded me of COVID, where, yes, there's the death rate, but there's also all the people with long COVID. That's another kind of damage. So in the ecology, we may not lose all the wheat when a new rust arrives, a new disease, but we may not have enough to feed ourselves. So there's that damage stage as well as extinction that we need to be concerned about.
Exactly, yes. And this comes back to the idea of resilience. Just because a community still persists from, for example, climate change, it's vastly weakened because the number of linkages in there, the number of nodes in that system have also dwindled. So coming back to that scaffold analogy, it's weak, and therefore when another disturbance comes along, and you can think of disturbances in terms of things like bushfires, you know, the people are burning down as we speak around the planet in different parts of the world. We have floods. We've just had massive floods in Australia. We have cold snaps, which is something that the deniers will use to say that, you know, climate change isn't happening, but that's actually a prediction of many of the climate models, where the extremes are getting more extreme. So when these intense weather and climate events happen, they just give more opportunity for massive collapse within systems that are already weakened through these processes, these ongoing processes. So yes, if you have long COVID, you're probably more susceptible to other diseases, your immune system is compromised, and you might even die from secondary complications, for example, high blood pressure or some sort of pulmonary condition. So yes, we have to look at all the elements that perturb these systems and drive them towards a lower state of resistance.
Well, we've got to wrap this up. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
I think one thing that I try to do, I mean, my job, I'm a little bit like what we say in Australia, I'm a little bit like an ambulance driver, in that, you know, every day I come into work and it's doom and gloom and the messages are not very nice. And it's some people ask me, you know, why would I bother doing what I'm doing, knowing how awful things are? Well, the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning is thinking that, well, yes, the future is likely to be ghastly, but our decision on what we do today is going to dictate how ghastly that's going to be. So it's not a question of preventing future problems. It's damage control or mitigation. So if anything that I do can minimize that damage, accepting that damage is inevitable, that justifies what I do. And I think instead of giving up, people should have hope that they can contribute to minimizing that damage.
Less Worse is Better. That is where we are. The new paper is titled, Coextinctions Dominate Future Vertebrate Losses from Climate and Land Use Change. It's published December 16th, 2022. From Adelaide, our guest is co-author Professor Corey Bradshaw from the Flinders University in Adelaide. To find out more and find links to the paper and all sorts of other things, check out my show blog at ecoshock.org. Corey, thank you for helping us understand the way all this life works together.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I appreciated the discussion.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.